This is a recording from the Art of the Start Conference, hosted by Garage Technology Ventures on April 21, 2005. This keynote is called A Life on the Edge. Jim Whitaker has spent a lifetime turning wild and crazy dreams into reality and helping others to do the same. He made the first American ascent of Mount Everest, led the first successful American ascent of K2, and was at the helm of REI from its days as a tiny local co-op until it became a multi-million dollar outdoor retailing giant. Jim will inspire you to reach for your own summits. Speaking is Jim Whitaker, mountaineer, adventurer, and environmentalist.
I'm probably by far the oldest person in the room here. I've had people come up to me when I give some talks and say, Mr. Whitaker, I read about you in my history book. And they've said, I thought you were dead. So I'm happy to say I'm not dead. I'm alive and well and enjoying this magical planet. And some of the things that you'll see here, you don't need a, you can put your notebook away and your pen and pencil. This is, a guy talked about the 10, 20, and 30, okay? I've got about 10,000 slides I'm going to show you of climbing and adventure. And you're entrepreneurs, so you're going to have to look at this in a parallel universe and see that this climbing relates in a lot of ways, not only to business, but life. And so that this whole thing kind of ties in together. So you're going to want to look at that and some of the things that I say and realize that this is a lesson that we've learned about life. And I've made mistakes like everyone else here has probably or will, and we call them lessons. They're not mistakes. And so we learn from those lessons. So I go through this talk as fast as I can to give these images and messages and so forth. I've got a companion in adventure here, my wife Diane of 32 years over here on the right-hand side. I'd like you to recognize Diane. And the 30 point that Guy talks about, I don't have a written line up here, so you're going to just look at images and get the idea of what kind of a life I've liked to lead. And some of the things I talk about, like guiding and like falling and so forth, some of them are lessons, like when you fall, you have to learn to holler falling. And that's something that you learn right away when you're climbing, because you learn that you're roped to someone. And if that person falls and you don't know it, they're going to pull you off. The other thing you learn is that mountain climbers rope up so that the smart ones can't leave, right? But you're tied to that person. Another important point is they say, I wouldn't climb because I'm afraid of height. Good. I wouldn't climb with you unless you were afraid of height. So you'd better be afraid of what you're doing. No fear. That's K-N-O-W. No fear. Because you'd better know it or you're going to make terrible mistakes. We've got a good fear of things built into us. It's smart. And nature taught us to have that basic fear. And nature is the best teacher in the world, as you'll see as we go along and climb a few. We're going to run up a few mountains. We're going to run up a business called REI. There's probably a few people out here that belong to REI. And that was a long time ago when that company started to run. So we'll go ahead with me being born. My father and mother met in Seattle, and they had a pair of twins, Jim and Lou. I was born first, Lou 10 minutes later. He said he's hated to stand in lines ever since. He also said that we were pretty good friends because we were womb mates. That's terrible. So we're moving forward here. I got into the Boy Scouts. My parents introduced me to the outdoors, mother especially, but I'd be wrestling with my brother in the house, and she'd say, go outside and play. So we'd go outside and play and climb trees and do different things like that I'm having trouble with this. There we go. Okay, from the scouting, we went into guiding on Mount Rainier. That's when you learn how to climb carefully and to be careful, because when you're guiding, you're roped up to this person that might not know what they're doing. So you want to watch closely what they're doing and learn how to climb. Rainier sticks up there at 14,410, a great mountain. Most of the Himalayan climbers of note have come off of guiding on Mount Rainier and gone on, like Ed Viesters, who's got 13 of the 14 8,000-meter peaks. I went to CLU, graduated from CLU, drafted into the Korean War. An interesting event, needless to say. We spent 2 years in the military. Luckily, I wrote a letter, found out how valuable a letter is, and wrote a letter to Osborne Euland, Scott Osborne, who ran a sporting goods store in Seattle, whom I worked for through college. And he was in the 10th Mountain Division, wrote to the Colonel Sheeler at the 10th, at the Mountain Co-Weather Command in Colorado. And I ended up 2 years teaching climbing and skiing to 10 Special Forces. The rest of the whole company went to Korea. So I thought, well, not a bad vacation in the Canadian Rockies. After that, I was released from the Army. You can't see us here. We're camouflaged. And went to work for REI. REI was a little tiny place up on the second floor above the Green Apple Pie restaurant. And it was just a little 10 by 20 room. I had to lock the door and close the business to go down the hall to take a pee. That's how big that place was. I put tents on the ceiling, and I became a salesman, because you have to sell. First you sell yourself, and then you sell your customer. And so it was selling. Retail, I loved it. And I loved our customers. I loved the out-of-doors. We'd get them out into nature. So the primary thing was to sell a good product for a good price and get them out into church, get them out into nature, church, the real world, where it's beauty and you're and the greatest teacher in the world. And so that was the thrust of REI. And it was how it started, basically getting the equipment. Then as we got a little bit bigger and better and began to grow, we'd go up into the mountains and you'd find some garbage on the top of the peak. You'd lift up a rock instead of trying to put your sandwich wrapper or your tin can of juice under the rock to hide it so nobody would see it. There already be stuff under the rock, so what did you do? You had to pack it out. So we began a philosophy of, if you take it in, you're going to take it out. And then we began a, okay, if you're going to leave only footprints, okay, don't cut switchbacks, stay on the trail. Different things, and we thought, okay, we're getting these people out. It's for the good of our company to teach this ethic. So it looks like no one has been into that area before. And so that was the thrust of the company. We began to do the environmental things that grew. I worked there for 25 years. From the first year we did $80,000 in business to when I retired at the age of 50 in 1979, it was $46 million business. We had five outlets. It took 25 years. You guys are going to go a lot faster than that, I'll tell you. But it was a wonderful run. And again, we had good people. But the good thing about that job was that I could go off and climb mountains at the same time. It's sort of related to the business. So I went to do a big mountain, Everest, in 1963. It was a long ways then. You had to walk 185 miles. We had to carry 14 tons of equipment to live up there for 4 months. So you go from 2,000 feet along a trail with 907 porters, carrying 65 pounds apiece up to 18,000 feet. It took us a month to get in there. So here's a route that Hillary and Tenzing had done, and we thought, let's do that if we can, and then let's, if we get a chance, do another route up the West Ridge, a route that had never been done before. Hillary and Tenzing had done the climb on the route that I had been picked to push. But we had to go through an ice fall that lay just above base camp, our first technical part of the climb. And You've got these big walls of ice that hang up there, and you don't know when they're going to come down. The second day up, after I'd gone up and put a rope up most of the route, Jake went up and the wall came off. This whole wall broke from one side of the ridge to the other and came down. Tons of ice, blocks as big as this auditorium were laying there and covering Jake. We dug and couldn't reach him. We cut the rope and left him in the ice and had to climb over his body for the next 3 months. That's the point where some of the smart ones said, okay, I'm not going up there anymore, and I'll stay at base camp and help out. We said, sure, that's okay, you can help out. It reminded me of an employee at REI. After about our fifth year, he said, I had promoted him up to a higher-paying business. He said, Jim, I want to stay in the warehouse. I don't want to go up. This is my job, and I like it. And he said, great, you're the best guy I could have. And this guy worked for 25 years in the warehouse, and he loved it. So you pick the people and let them do what they want to do. We established camps on the mountain. I met a Sherpa that had been on the mountain before, done a little climbing, and was a cook on a previous expedition. And so he and I hit it off. Gambu here stands about 5'2", which goes to show it's not how big you are, it's how tight you're wound, right? And so Gambu was wound pretty tight. And the Sherpa, we say, you know, they stand about 5'2". You don't see them until they take a deep breath. Then their lungs fill up and they block the view. They've got a tremendous thoracic circulation because they're born at about 14,000 feet elevation. So Gambu and I set off. It took us a couple of months to set camps up a day apart, because the trick is to set camps up a day apart, until we ended up going up with a camp here, a camp down, a camp up here. We put a camp right up here at 27,500 feet, which was our highest camp, Camp 6. And so from there, we wanted to go to the summit and get back to that camp in one day. The trick is to get back to the high camp. You've got to get down or you die outside on the mountain. So the leader of that expedition, Durenfirth, picked Gambu and I to make the first assault. So we were up here, sitting up here at 27,500 feet when a huge storm came in. Hillary was in a valley across, putting in a hospital with a bunch of Sherpa and Native people, and looked up on the mountain, said, no one will get the mountain today. And the rest of the team, no one moved. Gambu and I had no alternative but to go either up or down. So we said, we're up this high, we've worked this hard, let's go up. So on the afternoon of May 1st, 1963, Gambu and I crawled out of the tent and struggled up, getting knocked over by the wind. It was 50 miles an hour in the South Col that we left, and the temperature was 35 below zero. And we go up, we got frostbite in the eye, and we stumble and along, and at 1 o'clock in the afternoon of May 1st, Gambu and I literally crawled into the history book. And so so don't forget that the summit is optional, to get down is mandatory. They asked Gambu at our first press conference, what's the first thing you thought of after having reached the highest point of Earth? Now, mind you, it's 35 below zero and blowing 50 miles an hour. This is Tibet over here. You can't see it. Flags are fluttering. They said, Gambu, what was the first thing you thought of, expecting some miraculous, wonderful thing? Gambu answered for me as well when he said, how to get down. And that was it. You got to get down. You got to get down. So we spent 20 minutes and stumbled off the mountain. Here we are at camp. We spent a night at 27.5 without bottled oxygen, then came down to the South Col. You can see here I'm having a drink of liquid. You get dumb up there from lack of oxygen. What I did, we spent 2 hours melting water to have something to drink on the final assault. And an hour out of the tent, I'd put these water bottles in the outside pocket of my pack, which is just a nylon fabric. Okay, so I stop for a drink of water and pull it out and realize that I'll be damned, it's solid ice. And so to show how dumb I really was, both of them were solid ice, I put them back in my pack and carried them up to the summit. You really get dumb from high altitude, but the thing you have to remember is to get down. You've got to have that exit strategy, you know? You've got to have an exit strategy. And so we went down 3 weeks later. We put two more up the route that I did. There's the flag still up there. And two up a new route up the West Ridge. They got trapped out by darkness. It cost Barry Bishop all of his toes. And it cost Willie Unsold all of his toes. Lute could walk after being carried down to probably some people there at Namche Bazaar. I talked to someone that had been there before, where a Soviet chopper came in to pick up the guys that couldn't walk, Barry Bishop and Willie Unsold, and flew them out. We walked the rest of the way, the 185 miles back out, and we were invited to the Rose Garden. Gombu came, and we went to the White House, and President Kennedy issued the gold medal for the Hubbard Award for our adventure. So it was a great moment in 1963 to have done that. 6 months later, the president had been assassinated, and that was a tough thing. But they named the highest mountain in Canada, unclimbed mountain, Mount Kennedy. And so I decided to do an expedition up to Mount Kennedy, lined it up, talked to the Geographic that had funded our Everest expedition, said, I'd like to do a mountain, Mount Kennedy. And they said, yeah, okay. And called back later, said, how'd you like to take Senator Robert Kennedy along? And they said, yeah, okay. Has he ever climbed a mountain before? They said, no. I said, does he know the mountain had never been climbed before? And he said, yeah. And I said, yeah, okay. I'll give him a call. I called him up. Senator, you never climbed before? He said, no. I said, this is going to be pretty tough. We don't know if we can get the mountain or not. He said, I understand, but I'd like to come. And I said, okay, are you doing anything to get in shape? And he said, yes, I'm running up and down the stairs practicing hollering help. So I thought, oh, my God, what is going to happen on this mountain? Anyway, we shot up the mountain in good style. The senator was in excellent shape. We spent a couple of nights in an ice cave. They had members only spray painted on the inside of the wall. And on the outside it said Senate Chamber. So we got up there in really good style. The summit of the peak, we stopped below the top. It had never been climbed before. So we said, Senator, go ahead. So he was the first man to set footprint on the highest unclimbed mountain in Canada, named Mount Kennedy. It was really great. This is one of the climbs where you get the tears freezing on the parka because it's so emotional. And I ran the campaign for Bob in 68 down in Seattle, in Washington State. I had this picture in the campaign office in Seattle. He came in. I said, autograph this, Bobby. So he wrote across the picture I have, a big blow up. He wrote, Robert Kennedy, I am the one helping him. But we had a great run. It was great fun. We skied Sun Valley. Our families did a lot of fun things, and we enjoyed the family and the fun things that we could do. We were skiing, doing river trips, all kinds of things. That's John Glenn and Teddy. Bobby, Willie Scheffler, coach of the Olympic ski team. So one of the first parties I had back in Washington, D.C., I was sitting back at Hickory Hill, Bobby's house. I'm sitting there with Robert McNamara and all of these big shots around the different tables, feeling rather embarrassed when John Glenn stood up. And so here John Glenn, the first American to orbit the planet. And he said, I'd like to make a toast to Jim Whittaker. He said, to the first American to climb Everest, and the chimpanzee didn't do it first. I thought that was awfully nice of him to say. And I felt much more comfortable with the group that we were at. So anyway, had a lot of fun. The toughest part of it was being a pallbearer for Bobby at Arlington, and that was a low point. So, what they say is it's not how high you climb, it's how high you bounce after you fall. And so, I was lucky enough to bounce up. I had a tough life. I write about this in my book. It was the hardest chapter that I had to write because of what happened to Bobby. But you bounce back up. I met Diane on a national park tour in Canada, and we hit it off. It was love at first sight, as I say in my book. And we began to have adventures. Diane began to climb. She hadn't climbed before. We thought, let's go up K2, the second highest in the world. Why not? And like Guy says, I like women in the expedition. I mean, it makes it. Our first one was all men, 19 Americans. Second one on K2, we said, okay, let's go. And Diane was the only woman on with a group of 8 climbers. It was a tough deal for her. It's in Pakistan, and you have to go through this country to reach it. And we attempted it in 76 and didn't make it. We got to about 21,000 feet. Our team wasn't strong enough, and it was a lot of disadvantages. Diane took most all of these pictures. And we learned, you know, that you can't always get it the first time, but you also learn that success is sweetest to those that have known defeat. And so we went back in 78. I'd written a 20 recommendation note to the Pakistan government saying you've got to clean up your act in order for climbers to get out here and climb your mountains, which would be good income for your country. And so it worked pretty good. And they said, come on back. We've done what you've recommended. And so we went back with a stronger team. I picked people that had some proof of how they had climbed. The first team, we just sat around a hot tub in Seattle and said, yeah, let's go over and do it. And I was the only one that had been to the Himalaya before. So this time we picked climbers that had some experience. A couple had been up Everest and so forth. We set our camps up over here at Camp 3. We're going up to Camp 4, up to Camp 5, which Camp 4 is right here, by the way. A great view for the group. Camp 5 was located, of course, above 4. But here is Camp 3. There's two climbers going up to the ridge, which is the border between Pakistan and China. So China's over here, Pakistan's over here, and you come along to Camp 4 right here. And so this was a great camp and really a knife edge. One of our team, Ross Kelly, was sitting in the tent. We were sitting in the tent. Ross Kelly was outside going to the bathroom. We heard him laughing. We said, what's the funny deal, John? He said, well, this is really a knife ridge. He said, I bet it's the only place in the world where you can squat and without moving your feet. You can take a crap in China and a pee in Pakistan. And sure enough, you could do that. We had to try it. So anyway, we had a great climb. Diane broke the high altitude record for women in North America, getting 26,000 feet without bottled oxygen. So we did the mountain. We put 4 on the summit. Ridgway kept his fingers. One of the team lost a big toe and part of a lung. This guy, big toe and part of a lung, and we had to chopper him out with a Pakistan chopper to get out. But the rest of us walked back out. It was the first American ascent of K2, the first expedition with women ever to K2. On the second part, we had 3 women instead of 1 because Diane said you'd never go with one woman only, as one woman only. So we rounded it out. There were some problems. Sex does rear its ugly head, even on high mountains. You know, there are those that want to set a record of altitude record of sorts. So. But then the big one came. This is the payback that the guy talks about. The payback where you are going to pay back. What have you done? Okay, we know a little bit about mountain climbing. What can we do that's good for the world? The thing that we could do that was good for the world was, what is the threat to the world? Okay, this was the biggest threat to the world back in 1985 was we could blow the whole planet apart So we said, okay, who are our enemies? Who could do that? Okay, China and the Soviet Union, okay? So we're starting to brainstorm. And, you know, the wild and crazy dream is the first step toward reality. It's what you people are doing out there now. You've got this wild and crazy dream, right? You've got this wild and crazy dream, and you're going to do something that people are going to say, like my climbing friends, my brother, you'll never do it, Jim. You'll never do it. We said, the hell we won't. We're going to do this thing. So we went and got, we said, let's get the Soviet, a Chinese, an American, and we'll have a summit of summits. We'll stand on the highest point of Earth with our arms around each other, demonstrating to the world what can be done through friendship and cooperation. Together, enemies, together, standing on the highest point of Earth. And we'll do it in 1990, which is Earth Day, that's tomorrow, Earth Day, April 22nd. We'll stand up there, we'll take the garbage off the mountain that's been left there previously. We'll start to clean the world from the top down, so it'll be a clean environment, and no more wars. We'll stand on the top. What an idea. Can we pull that off? I was talking to, we're talking about fundraising. I was talking to Leon Gorman. I was at a Coke at an outdoor show, and I was just kind of briefing on the idea. He reached into his pocket, pulled, this is the president of L.L. Bean, reached in, pulled out a checkbook, handed me a check for $100,000. I said, what's it, Jim? That's a great idea. Go for it. Yeah, I've got $100,000, which brings me to mind of how hard it was to get the money out of the Geographic, to do our expedition for the Geographic. On K2, I went to him. I said, how about $25,000 to get over there? We'll get you the pictures. So we didn't make it. Came back. I went to him again 2 years later. I said, we're going to get it this time. How about $25,000? They said, Jim, why don't you just go and have fun? And if you get the mountain, we'll be really interested. So 2 days after we climbed the mountain, a runner came in with a telegram from National Geographic. Jim, we want all your pictures. Okay? So I went back and said, $35,000. They said, you got a deal. So I got another extra little shot. Anyway, we said, can we do this? And so we said, okay, let's do it. What are we going to take? Okay, we're going to smallest team as possible. Now remember, you want to choose people that you like, you want to, that you can trust and all of this stuff. We didn't know if we could trust the others, but we know we could trust who could we trust. So we said, let's get 5 climbers from each country. That'll make 15 climbers. Okay, then what are you going to have to do? You're going to have to have interpreters, because we can't speak their language. You're going to have doctors, 3 doctors, because we don't want to get acupunctured, and we want to make sure we can stay healthy. And so you got 3 support, support people, and so forth. So we end up with 5 support people and 5 climbers on each team. Soviets, Chinese, and Americans. That meant 30 people. It turned out to be a pretty big group. But I had the permit to climb China for the Americans on the Chinese side of Everest, Chomolungma, goddess mother of the world. And so I went over there and said, we want to climb your mountain. They said, well, you've got a permit. And I said, we want to bring the Soviets in. We haven't had Soviets in our country for 30 years. I said, exactly, this is a perfect opportunity. And so I made the pitch, and they said, we're not going to invite the Soviets unless we're sure they'll come. Okay? So I go to Moscow, and they pitched, and this guy came up, big bulky guy, one of these no-neck guys, starting up, and his tears running down his cheeks. There's 20 people that control all athletics in the Soviet Union, including mountain climbing. This guy's coming up. I asked the interpreter, what does he want? He said, he wants to tell you what you're doing now is the most important thing you'll ever do in your life. He said, the Russians lost 20 million people in World War II. He lost 3 brothers and a father in World War II. He wants you to know this is the most important thing ever. Man, I was bawling. I went up, we hugged each other, and he's crying, and I say to the group, I said, thank you for allowing me to make this presentation. Next day, we meet with the people, and they say, well, we want to do this. It sounds like a good program, Mr. Whitaker, but we don't want to invite ourselves unless we're sure the Chinese will have us. So the whole deal is nobody loses face. If you can do your deal and no one loses face, you got it going. You got some good things going. So I went over and I said, look at you guys. You got to bring them over. You got to bring them over. You got to do this. So I'm pleading with them. Finally, I said, okay, Mr. Whitaker, you may bring your Soviet friends to our country and climb our mountain. I said, great. But they said, but we won't participate. I said, wait a minute. You're our enemies. This is the deal where we want you to participate. And they said, Chinese climbers haven't had the advantages that the Russian and the American climbers have had. So I thought, oh, they didn't want to lose faith. I said, look, no one will go to the summit without the other two. There'll be no one or two countries on top, only three countries, Soviet, China, and America. I said, if the Chinese can't make it near the top, we'll drag him up to the top, stand in between us, get a picture, and drag him off the mountain. No problem. They said, well, we're not sure. And I said, America, we'll pay for it. They like that deal. And instantly I got $50,000 from Boeing. I got different money. It was a $1 million project. So finally they said, well, we're not sure. And I said, look, we'll bring you to America. We'll teach you how to get to the summit, your team up on Mount Rainier. It'll work. And so sure enough, they said, finally, after about 6 months, and I said, you got to have a woman on each team member. They got together with that. I picked out, our climbing team was three lawyers. It was funny, we got over on the mountain, one of the lawyers came up to me and said, Jim, you can tell how cold it is up here. I said, how's that? He said, because the lawyers have their hands in their own pockets. So we put this thing together, the Soviet, Chinese, and Americans. This was before the wall came down, okay? This is when they were enemies. This is when we spent billions of dollars getting ready to kill these people, right? So what was the goal that got us up there? They had a chance to go to the summit. They had a chance to be to stand on the highest point of Earth. What mountain climber wouldn't want to stand on the highest point of Earth? I said, we get these three people up, a Soviet, Chinese, and an American on top, then anybody that wants to can try and climb the mountain. We've got enough bottled oxygen. That was a funny story, but anyway. I said, we can do it. So what? Sure enough, we get over there. Actually, first we have a shakedown on Mount Rainier. So here we are on Rainier. Oops, we'll go back to Mount Rainier. The television comes up, said, Jim, what's the first Russian you've learned? I said, Niet problem, because everybody said, put the tent over there, Niet problem. And these guys came over, they walked downhill from their homes to stand on the summit of Rainier. Their homes are higher than the summit of Rainier. You should have seen. They're talking, smoking like furnaces all the way up the mountain. You couldn't believe it because they're acclimatized. They're so wonderfully acclimatized, which is the secret to climbing any mountaineer, Rainier, anything. Okay. So anyway, then they go up to Shatev. Shatev, what's the first English you've learned? And Shatev, on live TV in the Northwest, says, the weather sucks. It was great. So, anyway, we went over with this team, and it was incredible. There's Katya, the first Soviet woman of the summit ever. There's that. We had three women, and we did it. It was an amazing thing. It was lousy weather. We figured that the gods were all praying for us because it was a good deal. It was a peace climb. So we got over there. We're strong enough. There's some things that happened, but it's in the book if someone wants to pick it up. But anyway, I picked two climbers because we're so strong we could have two from each country on the summit. And so this guy, Ed Beister, said, Jim, I don't want to go. And I said, because you have to take oxygen? He said, yeah, I want to try and climb it without bottled oxygen. This guy now has 13 of all 14 8,000-meter peaks without bottled oxygen. Ed Beister, what an animal. The guy is an animal. Anyway, we picked two apiece and started running them up the mountain. This is the side to climb Everest. I know there's some people out here that can climb it. You know, the biggest thing against people that are trying to do something and are looking at things to do and to do is that they don't believe they can do it. That's the biggest handicap. They don't believe that they can do it. And you've got to just remember that courage is the first and foremost of all human attributes. With that one attribute come all the others. And if you've got that courage, go ahead and step up to the edge. And you can do things that you won't believe. And so anyway, this is the route to climb it. And there's people out here that want to do it. Go into Everett. You drive to base camp. To heck with a 185-mile walk. Or now it's 40 miles. Drive to base camp. No crevasses all the way up to Camp 5. No ice fall. You get up on the summit. And anyway, we ran the guys up. We put on the first day, we put six on the summit. Diane was back home, and we radioed back to her. Oh, God, talk about technology. We had a satellite. I talked to Diane like I'm talking to you here now. in 63, we had runners. It took 8 days to get messages out to Kathmandu. Here we are talking in 1990 by voice to President, we talked to Bush, Gorbachev, and Li Ping. And so here we are standing on the summit. Katya stood on the top, and we had a translator down here. She had a radio. She said, "I stand on the summit of this mountain for all the women in the world. Let there be no borders on this planet. Let us leave a safe and clean world for our children and their children and their children." And I translated that. It went all over the world. We got it to Beijing. We got into Moscow and into the United States. We came down. They had homing pigeons. They threw up in the air. There's 32 pigeons, and they throw them up. And I thought it was kind of fakey, but it turned out really good on Chinese television. And so here these birds are looking for the way back. It's 400 miles back down to Lhasa. And so some of them can't find their way. There's about 13. We have to collect them in boxes, feed them and put food out, collect them, put them on the jeep to go down to Lhasa. We figured those were the smart birds on this expedition. So we came off the mountain and, did some other things. But this turned out to be a wonderful success. It's another tearjerker, although it was warm water down in Lhasa, not tears freezing, but warm tears. And we pulled it off had an incredible climb. We put 20 people to the summit. You said you only had 15 climbers? We had such a setup. We had the fixed ropes in. We had the strength of the team. We put 20 on the summit out of 15 climbers. They said, "Where'd the others come?" We sent the base camp cook up. We just kept running them up. Guinness Book of World Records wrote it as the most successful climb in ever's history. No one lost a toenail and frostbite. It was an incredible climb. So what do you do when you're climbing? You think about, gotta be nice to in the South Seas, South Pacific, enjoy sitting under a palm tree and having a rum and coke. Oh man, that'd be nice. So we took our children out of school. They were 11 to 13 when we took them out of school, spent 4 years in the South Pacific. Remember, you guys, you're doing your thing, but you gotta get out into nature. And you gotta get out and have fun. You gotta enjoy fresh air. And so we sailed the South Pacific. We're gonna do the world, and we're having so much fun in the South Pacific. We said, "Hell, let's stay here. We don't need to go any further." So we stayed in the South Pacific, a family portrait, 80 feet down in Fiji. And the children learned these things that were incredible. And so what do you do when you're sailing? You're thinking, it'd be nice now to be walking up some snowfield, going up toward the warm rock and up onto the nice boulders and enjoying. And so what do you do? We decided, let's go back to base camp, Everest base camp. 40-year anniversary. Gambu, how about it? He said, "Jim, well, we still are alive." So I said, "Okay, Gambu." So we put together a group, took our kids, headed into Everest base camp, and had a rum and coke at the base of the Khumbu Glacier, and enjoyed some of the beauty of Chomolungma, the goddess mother of the world. So there's a final message. There's some questions that maybe you have about some of the things I've said and so forth. I'll be around here all afternoon until the program is totally over. But I do want to tell you one thing. And first of all, it's exciting that where you are positioned, whatever you're doing, you've got to be out on the edge some. So enjoy that out on the edge part, because that's when you learn the most, is when you're out there a little bit on the edge. The other thing is it's so nice to come down. We're playing for more than you can afford to lose up here, so you got to learn the game. And I think that's true in a lot of your businesses. But when you come off that mountain, you're up there for 4 months in the snow and the ice and the rock, and you come down, and you walk down and come and see the first blade of grass, that incredible green blade of grass coming up through the dirt. And you look at that, and the team would gather around and say, "Look, it's the first living thing you've seen, except maybe Gorak birds or something, or butterflies that get blown up in the ice. But it's the first living thing you've seen," and you gather around it, and you think, "My God," and you get on your hands and knees, and you smell the dirt. You can smell dirt, actually, instead of just rock. You don't smell anything. And you smell the dirt, and you think, "God, it's good to be alive." You think, "It's so damn good to be alive." And you realize every day is a gift that's been given to you. You're alive and you're doing this thing, and it's an incredible gift that we have, no matter what happens, no matter where you fall. Weaknesses, errors, and misunderstandings are the warp of a hard apprenticeship. But basically, they're just lessons if you're still alive. And so you're coming out, and you're seeing this, and you're alive, and you're ready to enjoy this magical, incredible planet. So I encourage you, do what you're doing, enjoy what you're doing, but don't forget nature is the best teacher, and get outside and enjoy your life. Thank you very much.